Okay, good afternoon. So yes, as is immediately clear from this title, this is indeed another talk about the dangers of using RC4 in TLS. But whereas the previous talk showcased work that kind of concerned attacking secure cookies, we now look at attacks that target passwords being protected by RC4 in TLS. So why did we do this? Well, despite kind of high-profile attacks such as those by AlphaDon et al. From Usenix 2013, usage of RC4 in TLS was still running at about 35% in December of last year. And one likely reason for this is that these attacks were not of great enough practical significance to bring RC4 to the point where it needed to be abandoned by practitioners. Oh, and these statistics are from the ISI notary. So we asked ourselves the question, well, can we strengthen these attacks? How can we do better? And we decided to target passwords because they are widely used for authentication on the web, and also they are not uniformly distributed. And maybe we can use this fact to give us a little bit of a boost and come up with attacks that are more practical. But before we get into how those attacks work, a little bit of background. Now, I know that the previous speaker has kind of run you through some of the basics, but let's just recap for those of you who might have just joined the session, and also because I put in a lot of effort in creating this diagram. So I am going to run through it. All right, so TLS is a protocol suite, which is intended to provide security services for protocols running at the application layer. And you can think of it as being sandwiched between the application layer and the transport layer, and TLS will run over a transport protocol like TCP, and HTTP will run over TLS, and this gives us HTTPS. TLS is largely made up of two sub-protocols, namely the Handshake protocol and the Record protocol. And one of the jobs of the Handshake protocol is to negotiate keys that will be used by the Record protocol to provide confidentiality for application data as it moves between the server and the client and between the client and the server. So RC4 in this handshake, So in the handshake, RC4 can be negotiated as the mechanism to provide confidentiality, and then the handshake will spit out two 128-bit RC4 keys to be used by the Record protocol. RC4 is an additive stream cipher, so that means that a byte of ciphertext is created by XORing a byte of plain text with a key stream byte. And something to keep in mind here, that the first 36 bytes that are going to be protected by RC4 is the finished message. This is important for our attacks because, as you'll see later on, this actually means that we can't target this field. Okay, on the surface, RC4 might be a really nice choice. It has a very simple, elegant structure, it's fast, it's been around for a while, so it's kind of compatible with a lot of legacy implementations. But RC4 does have a problem. It has a biased key stream. And it's what I like to think of, and some other people, as a fingerprint. And we can use this fingerprint to mount plaintext recovery attacks. I'm not going to run through why those biases exist, but this just gives you kind of a graphical evidence of the fact that there are these biases. So on the top, you're looking at single byte biases. And ideally, what you would like to see is kind of a straight line at 2 to the minus 8. On the bottom, we're looking at some double byte biases, and what you want to see in those heat maps is virtually no color at all. But this is not the case in RC4. So, how do we use this fingerprint to help us recover plain text? Well, in 2001, Manton and Sharia described a ciphertext-only attack where they recovered a byte of plain text, the second byte of plain text, by using the fact that the second byte of the RC4 key stream was highly biased towards zero. Now, their attack needs a number of encryptions of the same plain text, all using fresh RC4 keys. Manton and Chenier give the example of one email being sent to multiple recipients and the sender sharing a different key with each of those recipients. In the case of TLS, we are not going to do this. We are not going to send to multiple recipients. What we want to do is we want to uncover one secret from one user, so we need many encryptions of the secret from one client to one server. So we're in the case here on the right. Okay, now the procedure employed by Manson and Shamir was not entirely optimal, and I'm just going to ask you to trust me on that. What we really need to do is we need to employ an optimal Bayesian procedure to recover plain text. So what we want to do is we want to maximize this. We want to maximize the probability that a plain text byte, this is in the single byte case, will take on a particular value given our set of independent ciphertexts. If we use Bayes' theorem, we get to something that looks like this. And what's important to note here is that for each plain text candidate byte x, the denominator is going to remain constant, so we ignore it going forward. So what I really want to maximize is this thing over here, where this term on the right kind of concerns the a priori probability distribution, the a priori plain text distribution. And this term over here, well, it's actually just the probability that I observe a particular vector of key stream bytes. Right? So it's this. And I get to this by using the known single byte distribution. For those who don't necessarily appreciate equations, I'm going to try kind of encapsulate all of this in a diagram. So on the left here, we have our S independent ciphertexts. For a plain text candidate byte X, we XOR in the relevant portion or the relevant encrypted byte of the ciphertext, and this yields an induced distribution on the keystream byte. We then combine this with the known distribution, kind of like the previous speaker mentioned, trying to match the known distribution to the induced distribution. We also mix in the a priori plaintext information, and we spit out an a posteriori likelihood of x being the correct byte. Now we try this for all possible candidate bytes x, and the one which gives us the highest likelihood over here is deemed to be the correct byte. Now, Alphadan et al. Employed this procedure to attack cookies, but what they did do is they assumed or implicitly assumed that the a priori distribution was uniform. And what they did is that they built up a very detailed picture of the single byte biases in the first 256 positions. And they were hoping to use those because this is where the biases are strong, this is where the biases are interesting. But unfortunately, the cookie is not encrypted in those first 256 positions. So what they had to do was rely on the longer-term Fleur-McGrew biases, and this led to an attack which needed 2 to the 34 encryptions and had a running time of about 2,000 hours. So, luckily, when we attack passwords, we can actually do better. And we do use the fact that they are not uniformly distributed. We know that users routinely choose bad passwords, with passwords such as 123456 and password frequently being counted amongst the most popular. So in the Rocku leak of 2009, where about 32 million passwords were leaked, the password 123456 was the most popular. And what's nice is because of these leaked data sets, we have access to this a priori probability distribution. Also, we are now kind of not looking, let's get that away. We're all not looking at just at one byte, but we want to try and recover multiple bytes at a time. Whereas before, only one byte was recovered at a time. Well, in the single byte attack, not when they were looking at double bytes. Okay, so now for n bytes, we still want to maximize this thing over here. And this term relates to our a priori distribution for passwords, which we have from leaked data sets. But we have a bit of a problem with determining what this is, because what we need to do is we need to actually know the distribution for n bytes of the RC4 keystream. And we just don't have access to that information. And kind of computing it would be computationally prohibitive. So what do we do? Well, we kind of have to approximate it. And we come up with an approximation by making one of two assumptions. We can either assume that all keystream bytes behave independently, and so we can make use of the single byte probabilities. This is, you know, a product distribution. Or we can assume that a keystream byte is only influenced by the byte directly adjacent to it. And this allows us to use known double byte and known single byte probabilities. But at the time that we did this work, we didn't have information about the known double byte probabilities in the first 256 positions. And I will stress that you do want to be in the first 256 positions because you want to also make use of the fact that the single byte biases are really strong there. So we had to kind of estimate this, the double byte biases in these first 256 positions. And we did this by examining 2 to the 44 key streams, and it took us around 4,800 core days. So now, if you think that that's what we needed for double byte biases, to kind of get n byte biases, really would have taken a lot of work. And again, that's why we have to use these approximations. Okay, so now returning to our kind of statistical diagram, we now have something similar. It's a similar procedure, but we now are looking at n bytes instead of just one. We XOR a plain text candidate with the relevant portion of the ciphertext, and this yields an induced distribution on n bytes of the key stream. We'd love to combine it with a known distribution. We don't have that information, so we have to make use of our assumptions and come up with an approximation. We mix in the a priori information for the passwords from our leaked data sets, and we come up with an a posteriori likelihood of X being the correct password. Now what we do is we run through a dictionary of passwords with these, and we have the associated a priori probability distribution. And when we kind of hit the maximum likelihood, we deem that to be the correct password. I have glossed over the fact that we kind of now do need to make use of this dictionary, and perhaps now is an instructor, well, it's a good point to discuss what's different from the attack before, the single byte attack before, and our attack. Like I've said, we now focus on recovering n bytes at a time instead of just one. Also, in the case of passwords, we have rate limiting. So when I go to a website, I can try a number of passwords, usually more than one, before I get locked out of an account. So what our attack will do, it will actually spit out a list of passwords for us to try, with the most likely password being first. And our attack will be successful if we recover the password within T attempts. We now use dictionaries with the associated a priori probability from the leaked data sets. We can also decide whether or not we want to use our single byte estimator or our double byte estimator. Passwords can also be Base64 encoded. And what this will do, this will effectively make what we're trying to recover longer, but it does give us a reduced character set, and there is some redundancy. What we also need to think about in the case of passwords is, do we beat guessing? If we don't beat traditional online guessing attacks, then why go through this entire exercise? I'll get back to that in a minute, though. So these kind of form the parameters of our attack, or our attacks, since there are two of them, and we performed extensive simulations of the attack in order to kind of determine its performance. What we did was we encrypted a password from the singles.org leaked dataset and used the ROCU dataset as the dictionary with the associated a priori information. The singles.org dataset, this was a Christian dating site, and it was leaked in 2010. And ROCU was leaked in 2009. This is going to limit our success rate because there are going to be passwords in the singles.org set that are not in the ROCU data set. But this is more realistic because in a real attack, an attacker isn't going to have, you know, perfect information about the underlying password distribution. Our default parameter for our experiments, we kind of had a password length of 6. We set rate limiting to be 5, and we tried this for various numbers of ciphertext, starting at 2 to the 20 and going up to 2 to the 28. And our success rate was based on, we ran 250 experiments for most of our simulations. So these are some selected results. So here you're looking at our single byte attack and our double byte attack, and you can see that we're actually doing pretty well for kind of high numbers of ciphertexts. So 2 to the 28, 2 to the 26, arguably also a kind of 2 to the 24. But we are capped, obviously, and that's, I've explained, there are going to be passwords that we've encrypted that we're never going to succeed on because they're just not part of the Rocky dataset because we've sampled from the singles.org dataset. Something else to notice here is that the single byte and the double byte attacks are fairly similar. And the reason for that is that when we were looking at the double byte biases in the first 256 positions, we didn't find anything interesting, or we didn't find a lot that was interesting that was not a result of the fact that there were these large single byte biases. Okay, now, do we beat guessing or traditional online guessing attacks? And this was an important question for our work to answer. And we went about answering this question by looking at a well-known metric, a well-known password guessing metric, which is about the number of guesses that you need to break a given proportion of accounts. So on the x-axis, you'll have the given proportion of accounts that you'd want to break. And on the y-axis, you have the number of attempts or the number of guesses kind of given in log format. This black line over here was for a traditional guessing attack. I will note here that we did try to kind of estimate this metric using our attacks, so using results from our attacks. So again, the black line over there is for traditional guessing where you have absolutely no ciphertext and you can't use kind of that additional statistical help. And if you're moving down the y-axis over here, you see that your number of attempts decreases, and if you move across the x-axis, your recovery rate increases. So what you really want to be doing is moving towards this bottom right-hand corner. And for 2 to the 22 ciphertexts and upwards, so 2 to the 24, 26, 28, we actually are moving to where we want to be. We want to be in this bottom right-hand corner. So do we beat guessing? Yes, we do beat guessing for 2 to the 22 ciphertexts onwards. Okay, so our practical validation. We built a proof of concept. Our attacks were applicable to two application layer protocols, namely Basic Auth and IMAP, that we found. And what you really need is you need multiple independent encryptions of the password. And you would also like the password to be encrypted in a favorable position, so preferably within the first 256 bytes of the keystream. And again, this is so that you can leverage and that you can use those really nice single byte biases that are in these positions. Okay, so we're going to run through the basic auth case. And basic auth was kind of defined as part of the HTTP 1.0 standard as a means to control access to web pages and resources. In the authentication headers, once a user has logged in, the password will be attached to each subsequent GET request. So what we really need is a mechanism to send many, many GET requests because the password, like I said, is encapsulated or is attached to each GET request. And how do we do this? Well, we entice a user, Alice, to visit evil.com. Say now Alice likes bicycles or knitting. And we get her to kind of visit this bad site and we download some malicious JavaScript into her browser. And this JavaScript will be responsible for sending GET requests. Now, the JavaScript will not have direct access to the password because of the same origin policy, but it can make GET requests to good.com because of cross-origin resource sharing. So now we have a mechanism for sending multiple GET requests, and we also need a man in the middle over here because we need to tear down the connection to force the use of a fresh key each time. Because this is the broadcast setting, we need multiple encryptions with independent keys. We set this up on a virtual network using an iChair server, a man in the middle, and a Chrome client. And what's nice is in Chrome, we found that the password was kind of in a favorable position. It was within the first 256 bytes of the plaintext stream. What we were able to do is we were able to kind of send GET requests every 80 milliseconds. But realistically, to set up a TLS connection for the entire handshake to happen, you need between 500 and 1,000 milliseconds. So if you think resumption, you know, could take about half of that time, so about 250 milliseconds, and say now you can keep six parallel connections open, To gather 2 to the 26 ciphertexts, you're going to need about 776 hours. If you can further reduce this network latency to about 100 milliseconds, say now because of increased proximity or decreased proximity to the server, then you might be able to get that down to 312 hours. Okay, so to wrap up, we used a generally applicable Bayesian inference technique, and I say generally applicable because this technique can be applied to any stream cipher that has a biased key stream. We strengthened the results of alpha down as all, so we had good recovery rates at 2 to the 26 ciphertext versus their 2 to the 34 ciphertexts, and we could have an attack that ran in 312 hours versus their 2,000 hours. RC4 usage as it stands at the moment is at 12.8%, and we'd like to think that our work had a hand in kind of reducing it from 30% to 12.8%, but I do need to emphasize that there have been a lot of influencing factors. So to give a bit of perspective, here's a timeline. So in December of 2014, RC4 was at 35% TLS. In February, it was deprecated by the IETF. In March, it was at about 30%. And then we have our work being publicly released. And sometime after that, also towards the end of March, you see the Bar Mitzvah attack was released at Black Hat Asia by Manton. And then in July, the lovely paper by Van Hoof and Peasons was released, publicly released. And now we have RC4 at 12.8%. There has been a significant decrease in the use of RC4, but it is still being used. And the reality is that although it's a lovely stream cipher and has such a nice structure, it is flawed, and we really should stop using it. So, thank you.
So maybe as a designer of RC4, I should say I support your call to stop its use.
Sorry.
It's about time. It's an old cipher now.
Oh, yeah.
Good work.
Thank you.
So with this attack, if you, instead of having sort of fixed length passwords that you were attacking, if you wanted to do some kind of like website distinguishing attack that would... it would be like a very, very long password or something similar that would let you take advantage of, say, all of the biases and all of the key and all of the character locations. Would that be feasible?
So you're saying if instead you kind of consider looking at very long passwords?
Well, so if I'm trying to attack people on Wikipedia and distinguish whether they're looking at the Wikipedia article for cats versus dogs, then I can load them myself and I know what they look like. And if I can then maliciously cause their browser to make a large number of requests, can I distinguish the cats versus dogs Wikipedia articles from each other?
I don't see why not. I don't see why you couldn't adapt kind of the techniques we use to kind of achieve that. I would have to think more about exactly how you would do it, though. But I don't see why you couldn't do that.